Okay, I'm going to start in. The human cortex has about 100 functionally and anatomically identified areas. And the goal of the work I'm going to be talking about today is to understand what computations these areas do. And more specifically, I'm interested in figuring out a more or less systematic way for deciding what mathematical computation the areas do. And the general strategy is the following. Each one of these areas is believed to have a map of some sort in it that's presented to it, and then its output is some computation done on that map or combinations of maps. And the strategy I'm following is to try to figure out properties that have to be preserved by the cortical computation in going from one map to the next, so that and then use that information to limit the number of possible kinds of computations that can be carried out. And I'm going to give you a specific example today, which is the only example I know, which is the visual system in the primary visual cortex. About a third of the 100 cortical areas are involved in processing information about vision. And the very first of one of these areas is called area V1. And all the information from your retina goes through a little way station without being changed much to area V1, where it is operated upon. And that's what I'll call the cortical representation. Now, I'm going to claim that there are certain properties of this cortical representation that have to be preserved. So if you look around the room, what you see is a bunch of objects. But those objects are not obvious. It takes a lot of stages of computation to extract those objects from the complicated spatio-temporal pattern of light on your retina. And the first visual area does not extract objects. That happens many, many stages later. And so that means that things that later areas have to know, properties of the images that later areas have to have to extract objects have to be preserved by the V1 computation. There, as I'll tell you in a little bit more detail later, there are a lot of properties of objects, but one of the main properties of objects is its shape as projected on the retina. And this shape has to be invariant under translations, rotations, and dilations. And so the general idea then is to see what computation V1 has to do that can preserve the symmetries that in the shape symmetries, invariance under translation, rotation, and dilation. And what I'm going to tell you is that there are two classes of operations that can be done. One class is what the retina and another way station does, which is just a linear filtering of the image. The second class of computations that preserve these properties of shape, and I believe it's the only possible thing that preserves the properties of shape, and another thing that I'll tell you in a second, is a wavelet transform. So I'm going to claim that V1 is performing a specific wavelet transform, and then I'm going to show you some experimental data that says that that's true. Okay, so that's just kind of where the talk is going. Now, the very first thing is to tell you what is known about cortical function that is the framework. So I'm going to most of the time just give examples for a one-dimensional retina. And so here's the retina. And its dimension its variable is x, and the light on it is f of x, is the light intensity as a function of position, and that looks maybe like this. And then the cortex takes this information, and here's cortex, and I'm going to call omega in this one-dimensional cortex the variable that says where you are along there, and it does some sort of computation on this, and it gives some sort of result like that. And this is going to be called f hat of omega. And what f of x is the light intensity at position x along the retina. And f hat of omega is the firing rate of a neuron at position omega on the cortex. And all along the cortex here, all densely along the cortex, there are neurons. For every omega, there's a neuron. And the firing rate of that neuron is f hat of x. Now, one of the central concepts. Yes?
Has this probably a previous transformation before arriving into the cortex?
Yes. I'm lumping everything together from what's on the retina until you get to the cortex. And there are some other computations that are done earlier, which are basically linear filtering. Yes, that's right. Oh, yes, that's absolutely. Their firing rates is a transformation from light intensity to firing rates of ganglion cells, and there's some processing that goes on in there too. And I'm lumping all of the processing together. And mainly, what I'm going to be doing is talking about what the cortex does, but there are significant things that happens before then. So one of the fundamental concept. Yes, Fred.
Speaking about retina, it's just a fraction of the retinal ganglion cells that fit into your scheme of linear filters, for example, direction sensitive.
Yeah, sure.
So, would you mean to say that, so therefore, they're probably not along this shape?
The retina is quite complicated, and there are a lot of cells there that basically I don't care what the retina is doing. What I'm going to be talking about is what the cortical cells do in response to light on the retina. And so how it gets that way depends on what the retina does, what happens in the lateral geniculate, and what processing goes on in cortex. And I'm lumping all of those together. Okay, and so the fundamental notion about how cortical neurons behave is what is called their receptive field. And what a receptive field means is that you take a particular location on the cortex right here at omega naught, and you record from the neuron at omega naught, and you look at the firing rate of the neuron at omega naught for a delta function of light put in at each x along the retina, a little point of light, and I'm going to violate my convention of calling the firing rates in the cortex f hat. I'm just going to call this phi sub omega naught of x. So phi is the firing rate of the neuron at location omega naught in the cortex, given a delta function of light at position x, and it looks sort of like this. I mean, who knows what it looks like? It could look like that. Okay, so there's a sort of Green's function for a particular stimulus on the retina for a particular neuron. And for a large class of neurons in V1 that are called simple cells, they simply take the points of light every place on the retina and weight them linearly. And so so f hat of omega, the firing rate of a neuron at position omega, is just the superposition of of the weights given by at omega for a stimulus at every x times the intensity of the stimulus at x.
So is that really true?
Yes.
Change the size of the receptivity by masking.
There are complications. There are lots of complications that you can look at. But essentially, there's a lot of evidence. I mean, really a lot of evidence that a large class called simple cells behave quite linearly. I mean, and like everything else, there are always people who say, "Oh yeah, I found a case where it's not true" and things. But definitely, the preponderance of the evidence is that they behave linearly. Linearly, yeah. There are some simple cells that people say don't behave linearly. They're special cases. But anyway, they behave linearly. Yeah?
I don't agree with that statement.
Okay.
The cells sum energy linearly. They sum energy linearly. But the response of the cell, the firing rate, is highly nonlinear with this integral.
I think this is something we'll just have to discuss about and go back to the literature, because the simple cells, there are cells that don't behave linearly. Those are called complex cells, but the simple cells do, according to what everybody says and what my experience is, behave like this.
I think there is no contradiction here, because the model for a simple cell involves a linear transformation like that, and then on top of that, to get the firing rate, you can apply some sort of nonlinearity.
Oh yeah, there's a threshold function,
so
sure.
After that, yes.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and so
more than a threshold function.
Sure. Sure. There is. So basically, we're getting into a level of detail that I don't want to get into right now, and I'm going to come back and we can talk about it more. But what I said, I'm going to let these firing rates be positive and negative. They can be negative if they want to be too. And obviously you can't have a negative firing rate. And the reason for that is that there are two classes of cells at each location. One that fires faster when you exceed the mean illumination and over that region, and the other one that fires slower when you exceed the fires faster when you decrease the minimum illumination, the median illumination. And so this it's more complicated than this, but the stuff that I'm saying is not anything I've ever said. This is what people, this is just kind of the way people in the field treat these, and it's their idealizations. We can go back and talk about those. Okay, so I'm going to use a different notation so I don't have to keep writing integrals, because this is just an inner product, and so I'm going to write my inner product like this. And so all the way through, I will, and most of the time it's going to be a one-dimensional retina until I get toward the end, and so the inner product of the receptive field of the neuron at location omega with the light intensity on the retina gives you the firing rate of that. And I'm also going to sometimes use this notation here, where C is just that by definition the inner product of the receptive field with the light intensity f of x. Just sometimes it's more convenient maybe to write it like it's a transformation like that. Okay, so the job then at this level of analysis that we're talking about, the job of the cortical of the person who's trying to make a theory of V1 is to find the function phi omega of x, the receptive field. So if I could find that function, then I would have solved the problem of how the cortex works, modulo all the complications that I'm brushing under the rug. How hard could that be? You'll see that I am going to find phi omega of x, and for this one-dimensional case, and it's nothing like what the real cortex is. And the reason is that there's not just one parameter that characterizes the receptive field of cortical neurons, but actually what you have to find is phi sub p of x and y, and p is greater than 7 parameters. So the real receptive fields are characterized by a whole bunch of different parameters. And so one of the reasons the problem is hard is you have to figure out where all those parameters are coming from. Yeah?
What do you mean? I mean, to me at least, you know, the way you've written it down, it looks like phi is, you know, just, you know, it's a function, it's an integrable function.
It is, yeah.
Why, you know, why 7 parameters, why not? You know, it looks like it's an infinite number of parameters.
No, I'm just saying experimentally, you can identify a bunch of different parameters. And so people have actually, the first people who measured it in detail were Jones and Palmer, and they measured phi of x and y, and their equation, which has been confirmed by other people since, and it's kind of generally agreed to be the correct thing, is a Gabor function that has 7 parameters in it.
By y you mean omega, is that right?
Oh, no. Y is the x and y coordinates on the retina. Yeah, and it's a little bit more complicated than that because the retina doesn't sample the image equally, but that's another thing.
I thought the real problem was that even if you know phi omega, you have to, given f a hat of omega, you have to find what f of x is. You have to invert the transform. I thought that was the...
No, the transform I'm going to tell you is in principle invertible, and I would know how to do it in principle, but the problem is just to find what the firing rates are and to understand why it's that way. That's what I'm going to get to.
Is it really invertible?
Is it really?
There's no.
No, it really is not. No, it really is not invertible. There are projections that happen. But the class of mathematical operations, if you don't do anything except those, are invertible. That I'll be telling you about, or I'm going to assume that they are. Okay, so I'm ignoring time, and that's a very bad thing. And we can go back to that too. That I'm ignoring time. You can get away with ignoring time in V1. Not really, but you can sort of get away with it. But you can't get away with it lots of places. Like there's another cortical area called MT, where the neurons are sensitive not to the light intensity, but to the movement of a pattern of light. And obviously you can't there. In the auditory cortex, you certainly couldn't ignore time. But you can get away. At the level I'm doing things right now, you can get away with ignoring time, even though it's actually in there. Okay, so then the job then is to figure out a systematic way of calculating these functions, and I'm going to show you what the systematic way is. But the next thing I'm going to do is talk to you about what the problem of object recognition is. Okay, so on the left there you see a picture of a butterfly, and you looked at it and it was no struggle for you at all to see the butterfly and the flowers. And on the right there is the same image, literally the same image, except I've done this. So here's the picture of the butterfly, and this is a simple one where the butterfly is all bright and it's dark all around, and then I've taken this butterfly image and tilted it like this, and then according to the intensity of light at each position on this image, I have plotted it I've plotted it up here. So the height of the plot, the height of the line, is the intensity of the image at that point. But I've kept the color just the same. So basically, I just took the picture on the right, on the left there. I tilted it down. I took each pixel on it, and I grabbed onto it, keeping it the same color, and I pulled it up into the air an amount that is proportional to how bright the pixel value is. And that is the graph right here. And this is what your retina sees. And you can see that it's not, it doesn't just leap out at you immediately where the butterfly is in that image. And I've showed you that image, and you would not see it instantly. And the retina, no, the retina doesn't do a Fourier transform. No, the retina does a kind of linear filtering.
You haven't even added the background noise.
What? There's no, these things are identical.
Right, so you haven't even added the flowers.
In the picture, I didn't add the flowers.
No, in that.
Oh, yeah, the picture on the right there is identical to the picture on the left. If you took that picture on the right and you just squished it down flat, it would be the picture on the left.
Including the flowers,
everything. And I left it colored like that to give you an extra chance to see the butterfly and the flowers, but it didn't help much.
Where are the colors? I
see. The grayscale. I call the grayscale colors. Okay. So the problem then is that your retina gets a function like this, and it has to extract the object out of the function. Okay, now what are the properties of objects? There are many, many properties of objects. Among the most important properties of objects are edges, but textures and colors and one object occluding another one is a very important thing. But if you just look at line drawings, what you know, you can recognize a line drawing caricature of President Bush in an instant. And there's no textures. There's only a shape there. And so the properties of objects that I'm going to be talking about is just the shape of the object. And so on your retina, there is an object. And then this object gets transformed in the visual cortex into some representation that I'll do like that. And that just means there's a firing of nerve cells there that it actually is shaped sort of like a letter A where the cells are firing spikes, but it's not exactly that. And I just wrote it like this. And this is the cortical transformation that I'm talking about. And that's what I want to find the properties of. Now, the properties of shape, which is what I'm talking about now, are that the shape is invariant under translations, rotations, and dilations. And when you move around the world, your eyes are doing that constantly. You move your eyes and the objects shift on them, or they move and you keep your eyes fixed. You rotate your head a little bit, or the object rotates away from you. And as you come closer and farther, the object changes. And it's obvious that shapes, you don't have to, it's no struggle to keep identifying a shape. And so, for example, if I do this to the letter A, so what I did is I translated it up into the corner, I shrank it, and I tilted it a little bit. Still letter A, there's no problem with that.
But we cannot read very well.
Upside down, of course.
It's not just upside down.
Yes, that's right. You can't tilt very far. But I'm not claiming that we can psychophysically detect things very well when you rotate them. There is definite translation and rotation invariance, and there's a pretty good translation and scale invariance. There's a little bit of rotation invariance, but not very much.
That's a bit more tricky still.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of translation invariance.
That's partly because of the way the retina samples the.
It's not just, even locally, there's not great translation invariance in this stuff published recently.
Oh, this is psychophysically.
Psychophysically,
yeah. Okay,
behaviorally speaking.
Yes.
Not very invariant.
I accept that, but the fact is that mathematically, this is true, that the definition of the shape of an object is that it's translation, rotation, and scale invariant.
How about a lowercase letter B? If you turn it through 180 degrees, you can
make
lowercase.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't have invariance.
You're not really getting some recognition here.
Yeah, that's right. Fred's right. We're not talking about recognition. Those are the same shape. I'll tell you what's interesting, though. When my daughter was learning how to read, I was teaching her how to read, and she had a lot of trouble. She confused A's and V's, and she confused P's and D's. And she had to learn to tell those apart. That was harder for her than learning to tell a D from a B was harder.
Lowercase,
which are mirror images. Those that she could tell very well, but she would sometimes confuse a D with a P.
The rotational confusion I can understand, yeah. But what is an example of translational confusion that's hard to see?
These are psychophysical things that really are not, those are interesting and they're important and they have to be explained, but they're not relevant for what I'm talking about, because I'm not talking about what we perceive. I'm just saying the mathematical definition of a shape is that the test for if two shapes are the same is, can you translate, rotate, and magnify one and have it superimposed with the other? That's the definition of it. Yeah.
Rotations in three dimensions?
No, only in everything in two dimensions. Everything in two dimensions.
So in
vision, we have three-dimensional objects because we have a three-dimensional world. They get projected onto a two-dimensional representation in the retina, and those have to be rotated, and then we have to figure out some way to reconstruct from what's on our retina the shape, the 3D shape from 2D, and that's a different problem that's higher order than what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Need to preserve the identity of an object,
yeah.
Which may not be exactly the same as trying to preserve invariance of shapes.
Okay, so I'll talk about that in just a second. Okay, so this change from the rotation, translation, and in this case shrinking the letter A is what I'm going to call that operation G. And this is what is sometimes called a similitude operation. There are people who call it that. And there's going to be a cortical representation of this letter A. Sorry. Up there. And the cortex is going to do that. And what I'm claiming is, and this wouldn't have to be true, you can think of ways when it wouldn't be true, but certainly the easiest thing to do is, if you're not going to extract the properties of shape, of object shape, until later on in the cortex, certainly the fundamental property of shape is the invariance under translation, rotation, and magnification on the similitude group. And so I'm claiming that there has to be some operation, not that the brain does, but that you could do on the cortical representation down below to turn it into the one up above. There has to be some operation U that undoes what G does, and that operation has to be isomorphic to the operation G. That is, there's a particular group that the similitude group is a particular group called the similitude group, which is the Euclidean group plus dilations. And what I'm claiming is whatever C does, this cortical representation, it has to preserve those properties of shape. Namely, there has to be some operation U, which is not translation, rotation, and magnification. It could be something else. But there has to be some operation U that lets you see that the upper shape and the bottom shape are the same shape. Would it have to be that way? No, it wouldn't have to be that way. You could make a lookup table. Lots of ways you could do it. But what I'm claiming is that if you're going to do it quickly, there are not lots of ways you could do it, but there are ways you could do it. There are computationally expensive ways.
No, but yeah. You don't need to recognize shapes. I mean, what you need to recognize is, I guess, to recognize objects, which is not the same as
you do recognize shapes. No, you do recognize shapes instantly.
But you do not need to do that.
Yeah, you do need to do it. You have to recognize shapes. You have to recognize line drawings. That's what the visual system does.
I have to recognize an object behind that line drawing. I don't need to recognize that this is...
Yeah, but you can recognize the line drawing as well as you can recognize the object. Mm-hmm. You recognize it instantly, and that's and all that's there is the shape of it, actually the edges of it, right? Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
This is probably not irrelevant to your talk, but the thing that really impressed me about the visual system, you mentioned young children, is that this is probably higher function, right? You show a young child a picture, a photograph of an elephant.
Yeah.
And then show her a picture of an elephant dressed in a tuxedo, wearing a crown, eating dinner, and the child recognizes the same animal.
Sure.
So that is, to me, is much more
interesting.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is that called high? I mean, that would be processed higher.
This has to do with generalization. What classes of things do you lump together? And I would claim that.
Do you know at what age a child can actually equate those two things?
There's a lot of things that are known about that. Yeah. Babies. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to be happy if I can explain this. I'm not going to have to.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You have to introduce some constraint. Otherwise, you're going to do just trivial transformation.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what I'm going to show you is that there are two classes of operations that will do this. One class of operations are linear filterings. I take my glasses off and objects are still going to have the same properties. I can't see them very well, but if you blur them, their representation would have the same properties. In other words, if all the cortex did was take an image and blur it, or take an image and extract the edges from it, or something like that, then all I would have to do is do translations, rotations, and magnifications on the cortex, and that would be isomorphic to doing it in the real world, and so that counts. But what I'm going to show you is that there are, if you exclude those, there are another class of operations, one other class of operations that you can perform that are not the same as translations, rotations, and magnifications, and that's what I'm claiming that cortex actually does. And I'll give evidence that it actually does. Okay, so just to show you the principle that I'm trying to get at, and I don't want to insult people by doing some dumb stuff, but just to show you how you look, how you might do a problem like this, and how you could get things that are different from just translations and so forth, I'm going to reduce the problem that before to the simplest possible that I can think of example of it, and that is, I'm going to say there is only one property of shape, and that property of shape is translation invariant. And so if I have a function on my retina here, here's my one-dimensional retina, and there's some function on here. What I'm claiming is that any time I can just translate that, any function that I can just translate and make superimposed with that is the same object. So you can think about it this way. We have a little flatland creature, a little two-dimensional creature with a one-dimensional retina, and he's stuck in this world, he can't move. All he can do is move his eye around. And when he moves his eye, he sees Robin's coffee cup over there. He moves his eye a little bit, the coffee cup moves on his retina, and he has to be able to recognize that as the same object. Something else is going to have a different function on his retina, and that'll be a different thing. So things can't rotate because there's only one dimension. They can't magnify because he can't move. The world is fixed. All he can do is move his eye a little bit. And so this is f of x, and the cortical representation of this is going to be f hat of omega, and translation by the amount t of f of x is by definition f of x minus t. And what I'm claiming is that all the functions any function that you can make coincide with f of x by translating it is the same shape object. And this also can be written as e to the minus t times d by dx operating on f of x. That's just another way of making the shift. So there has to be something up in the cortex, U sub T, and remember that I said that, and this all equals, and then if you do the cortical operation on F of X, remember you get F hat of omega, and there has to be something up in the cortex that you can do up in the cortex. So you operate on the translated, the translated version of F of X, and that has to give you F hat of omega. So basically, I'm just saying that you move something on the retina, and that does something up in the cortex. It doesn't just move it, you'll see in a minute. But there is some operation I can do up in the cortex that will let you make the two, the translated and the untranslated versions of the cortical representation coincide. and so I am assuming that there is an operation like that. And the properties of T is that if you translate by T and then you translate by tau, that's the same as translating by T plus tau. And so that means that U of T times U of tau has to be the same as U of T plus tau. But one of these, the U's only work in the omega domain, and the T's only work in the X domain. So F of omega is a function of omega, and the U's only work there. Okay, so I'm looking now for a function for yes.
This in principle could be tested
experimentally. Oh, it has been tested experimentally. And I'm going to come to that later.
So because omega is the position on the part.
Yes,
so
it is.
You record that.
And you can do it. Yes.
You can move the retina, the object on the retina.
And see, yes. See. Yes. You couldn't test it in this particular case experimentally because these creatures don't exist. But what I'm talking about has been tested experimentally, as I'll show you at the end. Yes.
What is this? I'm sorry. What is this? What has been combination?
That you can make things that you can make things the same object coincide by translating and scaling and or doing something in the cortex. Yeah.
Chomsky, you must be recorded somewhere. It's somewhere other than V1. Because you do in the end have to know.
You recognize that
the thing has been translated at some stage.
Oh yes. It's not that the representation doesn't change. There has to be some place in the brain where when I translate something, the representation doesn't change. That's the problem that we were talking about earlier along, the perception problem. But you know if something's bigger, you know it's bigger.
Yeah.
But you also know it's the same object. And I'm working right now on the same object. Yeah.
Can you elaborate a little bit on this? Because C of F does change under the translation. However, U times C does not.
Yes.
It appears there are two representations somewhere in the brain, which one is invariant and another is not.
So now U is nothing that the brain does. U is something that I do, and the brain may or may not do it, but I can definitely do it. So just like if I show you a triangle or an A and a translated rotated A, if it was a complicated figure, you maybe couldn't tell by looking. The way you would actually tell is you would rotate it, translate it, shrink it, and make it coincide, say, yes, they are the same. You might not do that to find they're the same. You might do something else. You might figure out another way of finding they're the same. I might not. There's going to be a different representation with in the cortex if I translate the image. it may be quite different. There may be quite a different way of doing something, of finding out it's the same. The brain may never do that, but I have to be able to do it because that's what I'm claiming has to be preserved. That's all. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure. I see why that's obvious. I mean, the example you just gave is sort of why. I mean, you have this a complicated enough figure that it's not obvious that it's translated, scaled, and rotated.
Yeah.
When I look at it, and I can eventually figure it out if it's on a piece of paper. I pick up the paper and turn it around.
Sure.
Get a magnifying glass or whatever. How do we know that by the time I've gotten to the cortex, to my F omega, I haven't actually thrown away some part of the image that would make this whole set of sort of group transformations to use, work in that sense?
Well, because I'm saying that you have not extracted the properties of IMI of an object. You don't know what an object, the cells in V1 don't know what an object is. They will fire the same way to any object as long as one small part of that object looks the same to them. And so they don't know objects there. There are other places in infratemporal cortex, for sure, they know objects down there. The cells know objects. They'll respond to faces and brushes and things like that. So my argument goes, it wouldn't have to be true. It's not a law of nature. I'm just saying this seems reasonable to me that you would have to preserve the properties that objects have, the abstract properties that objects have, in the early stages of recognition before you have extracted the objects in order to be able to extract them later. And that's my supposition. That's the rule I'm trying out here. And it may be wrong. Maybe you throw things away. But it seems like a pretty reasonable thing to say when you have to go through lots of stages of computation to extract an object. It seems like you'd want to keep the properties of that object intact. That's my strategy for figuring things out. That there are going to, and maybe I didn't get it right for objects. Maybe there's something else. But there should be something that you can find out.
But your statement is dependent on which area you're studying.
Oh, absolutely.
You wouldn't say the same thing for IT. So then the question is, well, would you say the same thing for M4?
Yeah, and you might say the same thing for, say, there are things that you like this that you might say for MT.
I'm still trying.
Yeah.
Is it possible to summarize your approach by saying you're not concerned with the identity of things, you're concerned solely with matching operations?
Yes, that's right.
So you're not concerned with the anus of A's, you're just concerned with content-free.
The abstract property of an A is that I can tell two of them if they're the same or not. That's all I care about.
But you're not concerned at all with extracting attributes of things like A's,
no.
which allow you to say it's an A.
Yes, not at all. That's going to be later on.
What are you trying to get at them sounds very much just like template matching, right?
Yes, it is.
I'm not saying how it does it, Tony. I'm not saying how the cortex does that. I'm saying that it has to have those. There's abstract properties of shape. That is, it's invariant.
Okay.
My guess is that abstract property of shape needs to be preserved at least a few stages back, because you're probably going to have to use it. And maybe you would use it by template matching,
okay.
But maybe you do something else, who knows?
It's a non-lossy operation.
Yes.
So everything can be recovered.
Yes.
If I understand correctly, the aim that you have set is to find what C is given that such a U exists.
Yes.
Okay. Now, don't you also have to say that things that are not equal remain equal? Otherwise, I can choose C being something that's...
Yes, I'm going to put another constraint on right now.
Okay. Yes,
you can. Absolutely. Everything.
U.
Yes, right. Okay, so F hat of omega, remember, is just equal to phi omega of x, the receptive field dotted with the image. And this is an F hat is what U has to operate on. So U sub t operating on F hat of omega has to give the same result as if you shifted the image. That's another way of saying it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now what I'm going to do is what I'm going to do in this talk is not do the calculations. For some of you, the calculations that I would have done are going to be obvious. So what I'm going to do is just tell you precisely what I'm assuming, and then I'm going to tell you what the result is, and then you, and then if you don't believe me, you can ask me later about it, which most of you or many of you will believe me, and then after that, I'm going to do another stage, a more realistic stage of this, which gives you a result that is close to what really happens, and then I will show you some data finally. Okay, we're doing okay, I guess. So the first thing I'm going to assume is that there has to be an operation up in the cortex that does for cortical representations the same thing that translation does for operations on the retina. And we don't want to throw information away. We don't want to have to throw information away about the image. And so I'm going to assume that C to the minus 1 exists. So the cortical transformation has to be invertible. That means that all of the information that's in the image has to stay there in the image. Now, you might do something that throws it away on purpose, but I don't want to consider classes of operations that oblige you to throw information away. That's the first thing I want to say is true. The second thing that has to be true. The second thing that has to be true is that this has to be this you, this thing that plays the role up in the cortex of translation and translation, rotation, and magnification. Okay. What I claim is, and I'll say it a couple of different ways, what I claim is that what I just told you specifies the receptive field, and that phi omega of x has to be e to the I omega x. And that means that f hat of omega is just the Fourier transform of f of x. And it's well known that translations in the spatial domain are multiplications by e to the I omega in the Fourier domain. And so u sub t is equal to e to the minus I omega t. And because exponents add when you multiply things, then this operation forms a group which is isomorphic to the additive. Yeah.
This is your result, right?
This is my well, it's not exactly my result. It's kind of quantum mechanics result.
Oh, okay. And then the second question is, this phi omega x is not the same as the thing you drew on your previous transform.
This phi omega x is one for this special case where the only property of objects is translation invariance.
Oh, okay.
That's the only thing I'm assuming. And so if the only thing in the world you had to worry about was translation invariance, and the argument that you used to get for this is exactly the same argument that you used to show that that translation invariance of experiments is equivalent to momentum conservation.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm.
It's the same. There's a slight complication in the way you have to do it, because you don't use psi stars, which you measure here. But other than that, it's the same principle. And basically, what it turns on is this is the shift operator, and you end up with an equation for the an eigenvector eigenvalue equation for this receptive field function, and the fact that the eigenvectors of the translation operator are sines and cosines is the trick.
Sorry, if I wasn't a C being the identity word.
It would work. I rule that out.
Okay.
Oh, and yes. Okay. I skipped the big thing. So for sure, if I just copy f of x over on f of omega, maybe stretch it or something. Then u would be just translations, rotations. And the way that I rule that out is that I insisted that u sub t be not an operator like e to the minus t d by d omega, but it'd be a function. And I just forgot to mention that. This is a function. Why what?
Why would you require that?
For this simple example, to get away from, I'm ruling out linear filterings as, I'm ruling out linear filterings. I want to say, is there a class of operations beyond linear filterings that meet these characteristics? And this is just an example of the fact, yes, there are.
You're assuming what you're proving. If you assume that those are functions and not operators, then yes, but...
Yes, that's what I'm assuming. This isn't real, Misha, this is an example. I'm just trying to show you that there are assumptions that you can make. Basically, what I think is true is that there are only two sensible UTs you can have. One of them is e to the t d by d omega, and that is true if your operation is if c is a convolution. And the only other possibility is if u of t is a function, and that gives you the Fourier transform. And I just ruled out a convolution as what c does, just to see if there's something more interesting.
No, but I mean, so if I don't rule out the convolutions, then for any c, as long as c to the minus 1 exists, I get u by writing c, t, c minus 1.
No, it has to be explicit. It has to be...
Well, mathematically, it's not...
No, mathematically, that's true. That's right. I'll show you an example later. I'll show you, or maybe later we can talk. I can show you an example where u does not exist explicitly. You can find u by going back to where you came from, by inverting and coming back again, but there would not be a u that you could apply to the for cortex that has the operator.
But Chuck, it's important because I can't think of a convolution as a matrix multiplication, can I? Okay, so in some basis, I can always work with matrices.
Yeah.
Okay, so whether or not it's explicit in the way you're writing it analytically doesn't matter. There will always be a matrix that just by applying that matrix to a cortical representation, you can always do that transformation. So for any c, as long as you do this.
But that would be finding u implicitly, because that would be going back to where you came from, doing the t, and then coming back again. And I'm saying there has to be an explicit u. That is an operation that, Misha's point is an important one, let me just go on and then maybe Misha and I can talk about it later because I don't want to avoid talking about it, but I just want to get through the next part because this is just an example. Anyway, there is a simple operation that you can do in cortex, which is just scaling by e to the I omega t, that has all the right properties. Okay, so what I've just done is I've done a simple example, and so that would mean that f of omega here is just the Fourier transform space, and that there would be this explicit operation that you can carry out in the omega space without reference to the x space that would have the right properties. Okay, so
f hat of omega is supposed to control the firing rate.
That is the firing rate.
Position
omega. Yes.
So you claim that the firing rate does not depend on the phase.
There actually would be two neurons at omega, one for the real and one for the imaginary component. So at every omega there would be a pair of neurons, one for the sine and one for the cosine. So it would depend on the phase, and that's. Okay.
I have the idea that I understand what you want to require. So is it that you want the cortical operation that undoes your translation to be the local thing. And that is what you will later on require for the full point.
Yes. Okay.
You take every. You do it first, and then, but when you want then to undo the effect of something on your coordinate representation, you just multiply each firing rate in parentheses with this complex space. That's something that looks economical.
Yes.
You start by saying, okay, the cortex has these maps, and then wants to do local things, and that's.
So you're saying that some convolution on the cortical representation wouldn't be local.
Yeah.
And so that's why that would not work.
That's why Chuck would not like it.
Yeah.
But what is the condition there that?
This is an example, and just to show you that the point of what I did.
Okay, so you think that's.
It was probably ill advised just to even talk about it. The whole point was just to give a specific example of how you might use this argument and a case where the U operation was something other than translation, rotation, and translation. That was all I was trying to do. Okay, so now we're gonna have exactly the same situation. We're going to have F, here's X, and we're going to have F of X, which is what's on the retina. And this is going to go to the cortex. But this time, we're going to say this one-dimensional retina is going to go to a two-dimensional cortex. And one of the dimensions in cortex is xi, and the other one is omega. And what you have over here now is a function f hat of two variables, psi and omega. And the reason I'm doing that is that now I'm going to permit my flatland creature with these one-dimensional retina to move around. And so now objects are the thing that defines an object for him that's the same is that its shape has to be invariant under G sub omega and xi. It has to be invariant under G sub S and T, which equals S, a scaling operation where you scale by amount S and you translate by amount T. And what this G does is G sub S and T operating on F of X gives you the square root of S times f of s times x minus t. So this operation, the way I've defined it, translates the function f of x along the x-axis, and then it squishes the x-axis. It compresses it like that by amount s. And that square root of s in the front is put there to make this operator be unitary, so it doesn't change the size of things. Okay, so now I'm requiring that I have f hat of xi and omega is equal to my receptive field function, which is phi sub omega and xi it's a function of f of x times f of x dotted with f of x. But this is what I'm looking for, this receptive field function here. It depends on two variables now, and the motivation for that is that that in the real cortex it's not two-dimensional, it's multi-dimensional. And this is an analog of the multi-dimensions in cortex. Okay. There has to be a U, there has to exist U of S and T, which is isomorphic to G of S and T, but is not necessarily the same. And this G has a group, and the group has a combination rule like this. Okay, and you just have to work out what it is. And the identity is no translation and scaling by one. Okay.
It seems that you have just such axioms. If they exist unitary linear representation of usual group of rotations and shifts.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
The space of signals on cortex.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
This is your postulate.
That's exactly what I'm saying, right. Yes, that's exactly what I was saying. Okay, so U, the way that U combines has to follow the rules I wrote just there, which is the rules that G follows, which you can work out by seeing what rotations and translations do. I'm sorry, translations and squishings do. Okay, so I'm looking for a cortical, so up here, F hat of psi and omega is equal to this cortical operation operating on the image f of x, which is what I just wrote up there. And I have the same two, things I assumed before. U, S, and T exists with the properties that I said it does. And C, the minus one, exists. I don't want to consider operations. In actual fact, there is information that gets thrown away about images when you do cortical processing, but I don't want to consider classes of operations that necessarily throw things away. And that's why I made the second decree. Those are the two things. This time, I did a sneaky thing, and that is that I eliminated the possibility of a a linear filtering, because a linear filtering of f of x doesn't map f of x into a two-dimensional space. It would map it into a one-dimensional space, and so I automatically eliminated all possible linear filterings when I said that you have to take f of x and represent it in a two-dimensional space that has to have these properties down below. Okay, so these properties right here. Okay, I'm going to say what the result is, and the result is that phi sub omega and xi of x has to equal g sub omega and xi operating on some function f of x, and the integral of f of x has to equal, the integral of psi of x has to equal zero. It doesn't have to do that. In order to be invertible, in order to have c be invertible, this has to equal zero, and it has to converge quickly enough. And what I've just said basically is that C is a wavelet transform. So a wavelet transform, the way you do a wavelet transform is you take some function psi, and so psi of x might look like this. The way you do a wavelet transform is you take that mother wavelet psi of x, and you slide it every place along the signal f of x that you're looking at by changing xi, you translate it, and then by changing omega for all you do all possible scalings, and for each one of those you do a dot product between that mother wavelet and the daughter wavelet and the image, and it gives you a two-dimensional plot up there. And what I'm claiming is that when I insisted that U of S and T existed, that means that it followed this combination rule right there. that was enough to say that you had to be able to generate all of these receptive field functions by translations and scalings of one master function. And then the idea that c to the minus 1 exists requires that this function psi of x integrate to 0 and that it has a certain other convergent properties.
Is this the same thing as a scale space representation?
I don't know. I don't know what a scale space representation is. Okay. So, now.
So, how many labels are redundant? Right. So, to what extent is this representation redundant? Right. We're mapping one dimension on two dimensions.
Yes.
So is it redundant or?
It's
the equivalent of the Nyquist theorem? How many modes do we need to achieve certain resolution in the? In your space.
Gee, I don't know. You mean how many coefficients? Coefficients, yeah, I don't know.
And in practice, right, there's a finite number of neurons. What's the finite?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never thought about it.
What's the difference between the squeeze and the continuous wave transformation?
Yeah. Well, I'm doing everything continuously here. Everything would be discrete, but I'm doing everything continuously just to make life easier. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. So basically, then, what I'm claiming is that this two-dimensional creature living in a two-dimensional world with a one-dimensional retina and a two-dimensional cortex is doing a wavelet transform, and what that means specifically is that f hat of omega and xi, which is the firing rate of the neuron at location one of the pair of neurons at location. Omega and xi is given by this thing here, the receptive field function at dotted with the image, which can be generated by applying this operator G, which scales and translates a single function phi of x times f of x dotted with f of x. Okay, so what I wrote here on the right is a wavelet transform, and on the left is the omega and xi coefficient in that wavelet transform. And so what I'm claiming is that for this creature, that the firing rate of each neuron in its cortex is one of the infinite number of coefficients in a wavelet transform of the image. So in that, and if there really were all omegas and all xis represented in the cortex, then it really would be invertible, and it really would be a wavelet that you could say the cortex does a wavelet transform. A real one, of course, couldn't do quite that.
Chuck, can you actually define the transformation? What is omega and what is xi?
Yes. Okay. So. For example, phi of x might be equal to, let's see, how to do it. Okay, I actually was going to talk about one and two dimensional wavelet transforms for a little bit, and I don't want to bore the people who know a lot about it, more than I do about it, but let me do it just a minute. Yeah.
I'm a bit worried about this requirement of invertibility of C.
Yes.
Many functions can be inverted, but once you throw in some noise, the inverted function.
You're talking about sort of practical things, and I'm saying I only want to consider classes of operations that are in principle invertible, but in actual fact they would not be invertible. In principle they would be, but in actual fact they never would be for lots of reasons, and noise is one of them. Okay, so let me talk about a wavelet transforms a little bit. So f of x goes along like this. It looks like I didn't do it quite right, but okay, this is x, and this is a bird song. This bird sings a short high frequency peep followed by a long low frequency peep. And we want to represent this. How could we do it? We could do a Fourier transform. if you did a Fourier transform on this, you would see what notes the bird was singing, but you wouldn't know what order he sang them in and for how long. Another thing you could do is you could do what's called a windowed Fourier transform, and that is, and that's what people who study bird songs actually do, and that is that you would pass the bird song f of x, x is time, through a filter that kills all the signal outside of some small little range, and then you Fourier transform that. The trouble with that is that that if your box is this big, then you would not always have the same number of oscillations of your sine and cosine inside, and so you're different. You would resolve better for a given box size certain pitches than others. So the solution to that is to use a kind of Fourier transform, which is a wavelet transform, where what you do is you combine a sine and a cosine wave with the window, but as you change the pitch, as you change the omega in the Fourier transform, you also change the width of the window. So for example, phi of x might equal e to the minus x squared times minus I omega x. And this is what's called a Gabor function. And if I shift and translate this, phi of omega and, oh, I'm sorry. If I shift and translate this, then I get e to the minus x minus xi squared times an omega squared minus I omega x minus xi. So that would be my receptive. So if this is the master function, the mother wavelet, this would be my receptive field for the neuron at position omega and xi in the cortex. And if this is an auditory cortex, then I would have a thing here that would be xi along here and omega along there. And there would be a big spike of high frequency. So this would be high frequency up here. There'd be a big spike of high frequencies here that corresponded to this part of the song, early in the song. And then there would be a even bigger spike of low frequencies over here at a later time. So time is going along this way. So early in the song, there's a high frequency, low intensity beat, that's this. And a little later in the song, there is a high intensity, low frequency beep, that's this fellow here. And so this would be F hat of omega and xi. And so if this were a auditory cortex, that the firing in the auditory cortex would look like that. Yeah.
Possibly by your the function there, you have a particular position which is x equals 0, very special. Why is that?
I wanted to be able to shift around that one thing in both directions. The receptive fields are over there. This is just the function that I apply my stretching and translation to.
Just a minor comment. So this violates somewhat your.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't.
It doesn't integrate to zero.
No, no, I didn't scale it right. There's omegas in front, and it's not normalized.
Yeah,
but you can make it work. No. This is. That's right. This is actually a special kind of wavelet which doesn't work when omega gets too close to zero, but that turns out not to matter in the cases that we're talking about. Yeah. Okay. The way that you do a one-dimensional wavelet transform is you you take your mother wavelet, psi of x, you translate it over here, and so you generate phi of omega and xi at x, which is what I just drew up there, and you take the dot product of that and f of x, and that is f hat of omega and xi. So this is basically taking the song, at each point along the song you put your mother wavelet. For each point where you put your mother wavelet, you do all possible stretchings and squishings of it, and then you plot over here on the f hat of omega and xi space. You plot over there the size of the coefficients that you got out for that xi and omega, and that's your wavelet transform, and it's invertible. You can show that it is. Yeah.
What's g for this case? G of omega and xi would be what?
G.
I mean, you have to find q phi.
Phi g sub xi and. G sub omega and xi operating on psi of x is equal to phi omega xi of x, and that is for the particular xi, for the particular phi of x right here. This is what g operating on it would look like. Was that the question?
No, G was defined as a transformation in visual space.
G is the one in the real space. U is in visual space.
No, well, what did the real space is visual space.
Yeah. Okay. So G is defined in the X space.
Yes.
And that's where it's operating. If you operate on psi of x there on the left with g, you get what's on the right.
But g is an operator on a one-dimensional function.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So omega and why is it the same variable? Why do you have cortical variables in the substrate? And that's the translation and scaling.
So right now this isn't cortex. This is just a wavelet transform, and the way that you do a wavelet transform is you have two parameters. One of those parameters is how much you stretch. The other one is where you locate the thing, and then you plot, and then you do the dot product with your signal and put it there. But
psi of x is this thing.
Yeah, right. But the way that I talked about the cortex, the stretching and magnifications were also cortical locations. Yeah.
So, here the fact that you have the same that the width of your function is the same as the wavelength in the central, right? So if you mapped your one dimensional function to three dimensions and
yes.
you allowed the width and the wavelength to scale differently, then your setup would break down.
And that wouldn't be a wavelet transform. That wouldn't
well,
be.
I could define a transform.
You could define a transform that way, but it would not be a wavelet transform, because by definition, a wavelet transform is what you get from taking a mother wavelet and applying these operators to it.
Sure, but yeah. This is not a unique definition of wavelet transform. I mean, I could come up with it.
Any function psi of x that integrates to zero and dies quickly enough as x goes away will do as a wavelet transform. There are an infinite number of wavelet transforms, and the reason you pick one rather than another one is that usually what you want is you want to have the sparsest possible representation that you can get, because you just want to have a few coefficients that captures everything.
Right, but then I don't understand your claim. So no, any function can be good.
Yeah, but I think
yes, it can be. You get that by experiment.
What's critical is that the width scales the same way as the wavelength.
Psi of x.
Any function in which width scales the same way.
And it goes to zero faster.
Yeah.
To be normal.
Yeah. So Mitya, all I claimed was that the cortical transformation, to have the right properties, it doesn't say what psi of x has to be up there. I have no way of knowing what psi of x has to be. I just say that if there is a psi of x that has the right properties, then the transform is invertible.
Okay.
And you have to do an experiment to find out what it is. Or have another theory that says, oh, I want to have, here's the statistics of the real world, and I want to have the maximally sparse representation of that. What wavelet should I pick, or something.
So, but then the only condition, so does this thing that Fred said, the locality, is it preserved here? So can I perform
yes.
the translation and dilation in the cortex by just multiplying?
Yes.
So that's the condition.
Yes.
And if that condition holds,
yes.
Then the class of functions that satisfy that are the wavelet transforms, which are defined as functions where wavelength is the same as the width in the decay structure.
Yes, almost, because all on the right over here, the fact that you exist locally and the fact that C is invertible, all those say is that you can generate the receptive fields from some master function, and in order to be invertible, that master function has to have two properties. One of those properties is it integrates to zero. The other one is it dies fast enough. Okay, but there are many, many functions that could be psi, and I have no way of getting those. You'd have to have a different theory for the psis.
And U has to be a function, not an operator.
And U in this case is an operator.
Then it can have any function.
Because I don't think there is a function that'll do it this time. I mean, G is an operator, right?
But U is still local.
But it's still local.
Local to how much?
To the court. I don't know. Let's go back. I have to worry about that. Let me just go ahead so I can get to this, and then we can go back so I can get to what I'm okay. So here, what I drew here is a one-dimensional wavelet transform. This f hat of omega and xi is the dot product of this thing got generated by a mother wavelet. That's a one-dimensional wavelet transform. How do you do a two-dimensional wavelet transform? One way you can do it is you can take a mother function psi of x and y and apply to it two of these g's, g sub omega 1 and xi, and g sub omega 2 and eta. And the first one operates on x. The first one operates on x, and the second one operates on y. So basically, this is just the direct product of two one-dimensional wavelet transforms. So what you do is you take your mother wavelet, you put it every place on the image, you do all stretches this way and all stretches that way, and that gives you a four-dimensional representation of your two-dimensional image, which contains all the information. That is the way that the new JPEGs work. They do two one-dimensional wavelet transforms on the image to get the compressed image. There's another way that you can generate a two-dimensional wavelet transform. This is 2D, and this is the way that Grossman, who invented the wavelets, originally did it. And what he did is he said, what you do is you take a G that scales by omega, rotates by theta, and translates by xi, which is a vector now in two dimensions, and you apply that to a mother wavelet of x and y. So there are two ways of generating daughter wavelets from mother wavelets. One way is to take the mother wavelet, put it in every place on the image, do all magnifications this way, all stretches that way, do all the dot products and plot them in a four-dimensional space. That's invertible. That's a perfectly good wavelet transform. That's what the engineers do. The second way of generating a wavelet transform is to apply the similitude group to the mother wavelet. So what you do is you take, you move your mother wavelet to every place in the image. At that point, you do all possible rotations and all possible magnifications. And when you do that, you get a wavelet transform. And so now, what I'm claiming now is the following, that you have an image of f of x and y, that's the light intensity on the retina, and there's a cortical operation C that maps this into a four-dimensional space, which is f hat of omega, theta, psi, and eta. And xi and eta are where you put the mother wavelet, or where you put your receptive field, the center of your receptive field. Theta is the orientation of your receptive field, and omega is the scale of your receptive field. What I'm claiming again, and there is this operator G, which scales, rotates, and translates in the x and y direction. This is the similitude operation, and it's just like the same thing I drew before, except I'm doing it now in two dimensions instead of one dimension. And what I'm claiming is that if this is isomorphic to another operation that works in cortex, if this is isomorphic to another one, and if c to the minus 1 exists, and this thing exists, that then the cortical operation is a two-dimensional wavelet transform. And the way you show that is exactly the same way that you showed the thing once before. You just do everything in two dimensions. Everything is identical to do it before. So what I'm claiming then is that the firing of a cell in V1, if it's going to preserve these properties of the image, there ought to be a cell in V1 that has all of these properties, that has every scaling and every orientation and every position for every place in the visual field, and that it does a dot product with the receptive field of that function to calculate the firing rate.
But now you have more variables than you have dimensions.
Not exactly. So let me talk about what the real cortex is.
Just this thing U1 contains that you wanted on this view that it be local. I can see how it can be local for translations and scaling, but how is it local for rotations?
It turns out that what you do is, if you do it twice, you just add the rotations. It's like the translations and the rotations are the same. They behave the same way. Okay. So what do V1 receptive fields look like? V1 receptive fields are Gabor functions, and they look like this, according to Jones and Palmer and people who have confirmed since. There is a function G script, which depends on a bunch of parameters that I'll say in a second. Which looks at the light at location x and y, and this thing is proportional to exponential minus x minus xi subscript theta squared over 2 sigma squared x minus x minus eta subscript thetas on both of those squared over 2 sigma squared y times cosine of 2 pi omega x minus psi with thetas on it plus alpha, where alpha is a phase. Okay, so this has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 parameters. Seven parameters.
The second term under this one is probably a one. It's like,
this has seven parameters.
Why there is no cosine for y or sine?
That's just the way it works. That's what they. So if you look at, if you cut the thing along this direction, then it looks like a Gaussian times a cosine. So it looks like this. That's if you cut it in this direction. If you cut it in, if you cut it in this direction, you get that. And if you cut it in this other direction, you just get a Gaussian. Mm-hmm. So it's a long Gaussian this way, actually, a short Gaussian this way times a sine or a cosine.
But you're saying this is what one finds experimentally?
This is what finds experimentally.
Where's the orientation, though?
What Jones and Palmer did is they recorded from 2 dozen cells in the cortex. They measured this in two different ways. Once in a Fourier way and once in a direct space way, and they showed that the two come out the same, which is a way of checking for linearity. They found that there are cells in the cortex that have all combinations of these seven parameters, different combinations of these seven parameters. So they have different locations for the receptive field, different orientations around the centers of pinwheels that Fred talked about. I can't remember if you talked about that, Fred. Yeah. Different phases and different spatial frequencies. This is what they found.
I think that Desiree is actually right. There should be a second cosine or sine for y, right? Because otherwise you wouldn't be able to represent
a sigma. There's an x sub theta there. And that x sub theta is what you get when you have x and y and you rotate. And so if you rotate by 90 degrees, that x turns into a y. That's just the way
x sub theta actually has a combination of x and a y.
Yes. Yeah. If you have the thing in a standard orientation, what I did is exactly right. You can ignore the thetas, but then when you rotate it, you have to figure out what the thetas are, and those thetas are what you get by multiplying x and y by the matrix. That's what cosine.
So that's where
theta minus sine theta. Sine theta, cosine theta. Yes.
If I look at any given cell, they have only one.
Yes. So there are cells that have all seven parameters. This looks like what you would need for a wavelet transform. However, a wavelet transform can't have that many parameters and be a wavelet transform. The only way that you can do a wavelet transform would be if you have a mother wavelet and then you do all possible translations, that's there, that's the xi and eta. You do all possible rotations, that's the theta. Okay, so for a wavelet transform,
when you say you want a wavelet transform, you want a wavelet transform just because you want u to be a good representation of g.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So
yeah.
But local, just a representation, no
local.
Yeah.
No, just a representation.
No, then you could have had many other ones. Yeah. The reason you came up with wavelet is because.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so
the question is, how can it be local? Because there are only two parameters, two coordinates in the cortex, and you have at least four here, right?
Yeah. Let me
there are many though. Frequency tuning and the position frequency orientation.
Well, yes.
Do you understand correctly?
This is
a normalization for all of the cells. But any individual cell in the cortex
has one set of parameters.
One
unique set of parameters.
It's much smaller parameters. But if you want to have an ensemble of cells, then you can at least.
All different parameters.
You know, somewhere from going from a few slides ago to here, you went from having this 2D wavelet transform where you were doing translations and dilations, and now when you're looking at the actual V1, if we're, you know, sort of going with it, you have translations, dilations, and rotation. You have a bigger.
That's what I did here. I was trying to hurry up. And so what I'm saying is that you can go from the one-dimensional retina to a two-dimensional retina, and when you do that, all the same arguments take you from a two-dimensional representation to a four-dimensional representation in the cortex, and that all the same arguments give you, say, that the cortical receptive fields have to be generated by this operator G over there. In other words, they have to be generated from some master mother wavelet kind of thing by those things. So I'm saying that there has to be this. I just kind of skipped over this so fast. That was.
So the rotations sort of come in here for free.
Yes. Well, the rotations come in because you have to have the rotations to do a wavelet transform. There are two ways of doing it. One way is you can do all movements that way, all movements that way, all stretches, or all movements, all orientations, and all uniform dilations.
Do you have a homunculus looking at this activity?
Not me. No.
Is that a relation between sigma and omega?
Yes. Okay. So here's the interesting question.
Yeah.
If it happened that sigma y was proportional to sigma x was proportional to omega, then there would only be those four parameters that I put down here, and this would be a good mother wavelet. And so Jones and Palmer did not ask that question, but I went back to their data and replotted it for them. And the reason they did is because they were interested in other questions. And if you look at the Jones and Palmer data, this on the top is sigma x versus sigma y. It's kind of scattered, but it falls along a pretty good straight line. And down below is sigma y versus lambda. Lambda is the reciprocal of omega, and that's what you actually want to scale the same way. And that is, and that's also a pretty good straight line. And those are published data from Jones and Palmer. And over on the right, there are unpublished data from a couple of different laboratories they gave me. And this is a log-log plot, and I plotted sigma x versus sigma y for monkey and cat. And you can see that and they didn't have good data on spatial frequency. It's harder to get for some technical reasons.
So Chuck, just for curiosity, isn't most of the range of sigma y and sigma x in those plots come from the fact that they recorded at different eccentricities?
No. 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 Absolutely not. At one
eccentricity.
I don't know, but they had a kind of fixed eccentricity. How? Okay, so the sigma x and sigma y and spatial frequency are the three parameters, and for every pinwheel, as you go along one orientation in the pinwheel, you have a whole bunch of different spatial frequencies, and for every one of those different spatial frequencies, you have a different sigma x and a different sigma y.
Well, the range is no more than a factor of two.
No, it's more. Okay, I have to go back in. There's a complication about the spatial frequencies, which I'm not talking about. But no, there's a wide range of spatial frequencies. It's just that not uniformly represented. I don't have it here, but I have data on spatial frequencies in another place. And there's quite a wide range of spatial frequencies.
Because they had no way of knowing where and beyond where.
Yeah, sure they did.
They know where the receptive field is.
Yeah, they know where the receptive field is. They just put all the receptive fields at some number of degrees out from the center of vision.
No, but they stuck the electrode, and then, okay, so the receptive field is here. But I don't think that they would
not recorded, the receptive field was in
the temperature. Such a scalar should be done for cells with similar receptive field position.
No, they are. Michi, I promise you that it's really true that within a range where the receptive, where the eccentricity is the same, you get a wide range of sigmas. You really do.
With this data, what I'm that may be true, but this data come from different eccentricities.
Oh, the one on the right probably does come from different eccentricities. The one on the left, I think, not very different. Jones and Palmer used about the same eccentricities.
Because, I mean, of course, when you mix it up, then you would get this for free. Yeah?
Right, so that wasn't part really of your theory.
You wouldn't get it for free.
Or for
because because according to Jones and Palmer, you could have anything. Right, there's no reason why, especially the bottom one is important. There's no reason why the wavelength of the spatial frequency and actually sigma x and sigma x essentially equals lambda. In other words, the reciprocal spatial frequency, the wavelength is essentially equal to sigma x.
But that's a different thing than what you're talking about, because then at one part in the cortex you would represent one spatial frequency. That's what
magnification factor is. But no, but Nietzsche, that if you go in one pinwheel and you go along a pinwheel column, you have all the spatial frequencies represented there.
Well, not all. I mean, well, yeah, certain range. But what I'm saying is that this data wasn't obtained this way.
So you're saying the range is only factor of 2 and not factor of 10?
Variability, but it's very hard. I mean, people have tried to image, you know, spatial frequency.
But they can't do because the signal is too small.
They're recorded also.
And when you record, you see a wide range. You really do see a wide range. Well, we'll have to look at some data. I don't know.
This is three orders of magnitude.
Oh, but these are two different species.
Something that I found a bit surprising is that why is the intercept for the monkey and the cat are the same? Because the intercept here is the proportionality between sigma x and sigma y.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, I think we need to let me just finish up just 1 second and then we can, I'll talk as long as you want me to. Okay. So, what have I done? What have I tried to do? And that is, I've said there are these symmetries that need to be preserved when you do a computation. Why? You wouldn't have to do it that way, but it seems like the sort of thing that you'd want to do so that you don't have to be calculating all the time to figure out what these properties of the image are. If you assume that, and you assume you want to consider only invertible classes of operations that are in principle invertible, although they might not be in specific cases for many reasons, then you're driven to, I claim, to a wavelet transform as what simple cells in V1 are doing. Then, is it true that V1 simple cells are doing a wavelet transform? I don't know if they care, I don't know if they want to, I don't know if they do anything with it, but a simple description of what V1 simple cells do is to say the firing of a simple cell it represents a wavelet transform because it's the dot product of a receptive field that can be generated from a mother wavelet the way you do with wavelet transforms, and that you have in a given region you have all possible orientations for cortex, you have all possible orientations, all possible centers of receptive fields, and all possible spatial frequencies, except there's a problem with the spatial frequencies, which I don't want to talk about. It's actually an interesting problem. It's part of the computation that gets done. But we can barely just talk about this. So, okay, thank you.